ivy, he says, taking Paul by the arm. Where we put it. But Paul shakes him off and begins toward the stairs on his own. In the far distance, there comes the sound of sirens. We can't leave, I call out. Gil glances at me, but follows him. The sirens are closer now, blocks away, but rising. Outside, through the window, the hills are the color of metal. In a church somewhere, it's Easter. I lied to the police about Vincent, Paul cries back. I can't be here when they find him. I follow them out the front door, pushing toward the Saab. Gil fires the engine, flooding it with gas, and the car roars in neutral, loud enough to bring on the lights in the house next door. Throwing the gear shift into first, he guns the engine again. When the tires catch asphalt, the car rockets into motion. Just as Gil turns onto an adjoining road, the first patrol car arrives at the opposite end of the street. We watch as it comes to a stop in front of Taft's house. Where are we going? Gil says, glancing at Paul in the rearview mirror. Ivy, he says. Chapter 28. The club is silent when we arrive. Someone has piled rags on the floor of the main hall to sop up the alcohol Parker spilled, but puddles of booze still glisten. Curtains and tablecloths are stained. Nowhere is the staff to be found. Kelly Danner seems to have emptied the club of every last soul. The carpet on the stairway to the second floor is damp underfoot, where partygoers have trudged alcohol up on the bottoms of their shoes. At the entrance to the officers' room, Gil closes the door and flicks on the overhead lamp. The remains of the broken wet bar are pushed up into a corner. A fire has been left to die in the fireplace, but the embers are still raw, spitting up stray flames and red heat. Seeing the phone on the table, I think of the number I couldn't remember when Gil's cell phone went dead, and it comes to me suddenly what all of this is. A failure of memory. A miscommunication. The line connecting Richard Curry to Paul has filled with static, and somehow, Curry's message was lost. Yet Curry had made his demands clear. Tell me where the blueprint is, Vincent, he said at the Good Friday lecture, and you won't see me again. That's the only business we have anymore. But Taft refused. Gil produces a key and opens the mahogany lockbox. Here, he says to Paul, pulling out the map. I can see Curry again, advancing toward Paul in the courtyard, then backing away toward the chapel, toward Dickinson Hall, and Bill Stein's office. Jesus, Gil says, how are we going to deal with this? Call the police, I tell him. Curry could come for Paul. No, Paul says, he won't hurt me. But Gil meant something else, dealing with what we've done, fleeing Taft's house. Curry killed Taft, he says. I lock the door. And he killed Stein. The room suddenly feels airtight. The wreckage of the wet bar brought up from downstairs gives the place a sweet, rotten odor. Gil stands at the head of the table, speechless. He won't hurt me, Paul repeats. But I remember the letter we found in Stein's desk. I have a proposition for you. There's more than enough here to suit both of us. Followed by Curry's reply, which I'd misunderstood until now. What about Paul? He will, I say. You're wrong, Tom, Paul snaps. But I'm seeing more and more clearly where this all leads. You showed Curry the diary when we went to the exhibit, I tell him. He knew Taft had stolen it. Yes, but Stein even told him they were going to steal your thesis. Curry wanted to get it before they did, Tom. Then, at the hospital, you told him everything you'd found. You even told him you were looking for the blueprint. I reach for the phone, but Paul places a hand down on the receiver, holding it in place. Stop, Tom, he says. Listen to me. He killed them. Now it's Paul who leans in, looking heartbroken, to say something Gil and I don't expect. Yes, that's what I'm telling you. Will you just listen? That's what he meant at the hospital. Remember, just before you came into the waiting room? We understand each other, son. He told me he couldn't sleep because he was worried about me. So? Paul's voice trembles. Then he said, if I'd known what you were going to do, I would have done things differently. Richard thought I knew he'd killed Bill. He meant he would have done it differently if he'd known I was going to leave Vincent's lecture early. That way the police wouldn't have come looking for me. Gil begins pacing. On the far side of the room, a log breaks in the fireplace. Remember the poem he mentioned at the exhibit?
Browning. Andrea del Sarto.
How did it go?
You do what many dream of all their lives, I tell him. Dream, strive to do, and agonize to do, and fail in doing.
Why would he choose that poem?
Because it went with the del Sarto painting.
Paul bangs his hand on the table. No, because we solved what he and your father and Vincent never solved, what Richard dreamed of doing all his life, what he strove and agonized and failed in doing.
A frustration has come over him that I haven't seen since we worked together, when he seemed to expect that we could act as a single organism, think a single thought.
It shouldn't be taking you that long. It shouldn't be that hard.
We're riddling again, puzzling meaning from a man he thinks we ought to know equally. I've never understood Kelowna or Curry well enough for Paul. I don't understand, Gil says, seeing that something has come between us, something outside his experience.
The paintings, Paul says, still to me, trying to make me see. The stories of Joseph. I even told you what they meant. We just didn't know what Richard was getting at. Now, Jacob loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors.
He waits for me to give some signal, to tell him I understand, but I can't.
It's a gift, he says finally. Richard thinks he's giving me a gift.
A gift? Gil asks. Have you lost your mind? What gift?
This, Paul says, extending his arms, encompassing everything. What he did to Bill. What he did to Vincent. He stopped them from taking it away from me. He's giving me what I found in the hypnerotomachia.
There's an awful equanimity when he says it. Fear and pride and sadness circling around a quiet certainty.
Vincent stole it from him 30 years ago, Paul says. Richard wouldn't let the same thing happen to me.
Curry lied to Stein, I tell him, unwilling to let him be fooled by a man trading on an orphan's weakness. He lied to Taft. He's doing the same thing to you. But Paul is past the point of doubting. Beneath the horror and disbelief in his voice is something approaching gratitude. Here we are, in another room of borrowed paintings, another exhibit in the Museum of Fatherhood Curry built for the son he never had, and the gestures have become so grand that the motives are unimportant. It's a final wedge. It reminds me suddenly that Paul and I are not brothers, that we believe in different things.
Gil begins to speak, coming between us to bring this discussion back to Earth, when a shuffling sound comes from outside. All three of us turn. What the hell was that? Gil says. Then Curry's voice comes. Paul, he murmurs from just on the other side of the door. We all freeze.
Richard, Paul says, coming to, and before Gil or I can stop him, he reaches for the lock. Get away from there, Gil says.
But Paul has already unfastened the door, and a hand on the other side has turned the knob. There, standing in the threshold, wearing the same black suit from last night, is Richard Curry. He's wild-eyed, startled. There's something in his hand.
I need to speak to Paul alone, he says in a hoarse voice.
Paul sees what we must all see, the mist of blood near the collar of his dress shirt.
"Get out of here," Gil barks.
"What have you done?"
Paul says. Kari stares at him, then raises an arm, holding something in an outstretched hand. Gil eases forward into the hallway.
"Get out," he repeats.
Kari ignores him.
"I have it, Paul. The blueprint. Take it."
"You're not going near him," Gil says, voice shaking. "We're calling the police." My eyes are trained on the dark sheaf in Curry's hand. I step into the hall beside Gil so that we're both in front of Paul. Just as Gil reaches for his cell phone, though, Curry catches us off guard. In a single movement, he lunges between us, pushing Paul back into the officer's room and slams the door. Before Gil and I can move, the lock clicks into place. Gil pounds on the wood with his fist.
"Open it!"
he screams as he pushes me back and forces his shoulder into the door. The thick wood panel gives nothing. We back up and give two blows together until the lock seems to bow. Each time, I hear sounds on the other side.
"One more!" Gil yells.
On the third push, the metal lock snaps out of its joint and the door flies open with the sound of a single gunshot. We catapult into the room to see Curry and Paul at opposite ends of the fireplace. Curry's hand is still outstretched. Gil charges toward them, striking Curry at full speed, knocking him onto the floor by the hearth. Curry's head scrapes the metal grill off its mark, making sparks fly and embers suddenly pulse with color.
"Richard," Paul says, running toward him.
Paul pulls Curry from the hearth and props him against the wet bar. The gash in the man's head is pouring blood into his eyes as he struggles to orient himself. Only now do I see the blueprint in Paul's hand.
"Are you okay?" Paul says, shaking Curry's shoulders. "He needs an ambulance."
But Gil is focused. "The police will take care of him." It's then that I feel the great rush of heat. The back of Curry's jacket has caught fire. Now the wet bar has burst into flame.
"Get back," Gil barks.
"But I'm frozen in place." The fire is rising toward the ceiling, across the curtains pressed against the wall. Accelerated by the alcohol, the blaze is moving with speed, swallowing up everything around it.
"Tom," Gil barks, "get them away from here. I'm going for an extinguisher."
With Paul's help, Curry is pushing himself to his feet. Suddenly, the man shoves Paul off and staggers into the hallway, pulling off his jacket.
"Richard!"
Paul pleads through the door. Gil races back through the door and begins hosing the curtains with the extinguisher, but the fire's growing too quickly to be put out. Smoke rolls from the doorway along the ceiling. Finally, we retreat toward the door, forced out by the heat and smoke. I cover my mouth with my hand, feeling my lungs tighten. When I turn toward the stairs, I can make out Paul and Curry struggling through a thick cloud of black smoke, their voices rising. I cry out Paul's name, but the bottles in the wet bar begin to explode, drowning out my voice. Gil is hit by the first wave of shards. I pull him out of the way, listening for a response from Paul. Then, through the smoke, I hear it.
"Go, Tom! Get out!"
The walls are sprayed with tiny reflections of fire. A bottleneck comes pitching into the air over the stairs. It hangs above us, spraying flames, then tumbles to the first floor. For a second, there's nothing. Then the glass lands in the pile of soaking rags, finding the whiskey and brandy and gin, and the floor flashes to life. From below come popping sounds, wood combusting, fire spreading. The front door is already blocked. Gil is bellowing into his cell phone, calling for help. The fire is rising toward the second floor. My mind seems lit with sparks, a white light when I close my eyes. I'm floating, buoyed by the heat. Everything seems so slow, so heavy. Ceiling plaster crashes to the ground. The dance floor is shimmering like a mirage.
"How do we get out?"
I shout. "The service stairway," Gil says. "Upstairs!" "Paul!" I yell. But there's no answer. I inch toward the stairs, and now their voices have disappeared. Paul and Curry are gone. "Paul!" I bellow. The blaze has swallowed up the officers' room and begins moving toward us. I feel a strange numbness in my thigh. Gil turns to me, pointing. My pant leg is torn open. Blood is running down the tuxedo fabric, black on black. He pulls off his jacket and ties it around the gash. The tunnel of fire seems to close in around us, urging us up the stairs. The air is almost black. Gil pushes me up toward the third floor. At the top, nothing is visible, only grades of shadow. A band of light glows beneath a door at the end of the hall. We move forward. The fire has come to the foot of the stairs, but seems to remain at bay. Then I hear it. A high, collapsing moan coming from inside the room. The sound freezes us momentarily. Then Gil lunges forward and opens the door. When he does, the sensation of drunkenness from the ball returns to me. Bodily warmth, like the tingle of flight. Katie's touch on me, Katie's breath on me, Katie's lips on me. Richard Curry stands arguing with Paul behind a long table at the far end of the room. There's an empty bottle in his hand. His head lolls on his shoulders, pouring blood. There's nothing but the smell of alcohol here, the remnants of a bottle poured over the table, a cabinet in the wall opened to reveal another stash of liquor, an old Ivy president's secret. The room is as long as the building's breadth, framed in silver by the moonlight. Shelves of books with leather spines line the walls, deep into the darkness beyond Curry's head. On the north-facing wall, there are two windows. Puddles glisten everywhere.
"Paul!"
Gil yells.
"He's blocking the service stairs, behind you!"
Paul turns to look, but Curry's eyes are fixed on Gil and me. I'm paralyzed by the sight of him. The ridges of his face are so drawn that gravity seems to be pulling at him, dragging him down.
"Richard," Paul says firmly, as if to a child, "we all have to get out."
"Move away!" Gil shouts, stepping forward. But as he does, Curry smashes the bottle on a table and lunges, swiping Gil's arm with the jagged bottleneck. Blood runs between Gil's fingers in black ribbons. He staggers back, watching the blood pour onto his arm. Seeing this, Paul sags against the wall.
"Here!"
I call out, yanking the handkerchief from my pocket. Gil moves slowly. When he pulls a hand away to take the cloth, I see how deep the cut is. Blood runs over the furrow as soon as the pressure is gone.
"Go!"
I say, pulling him to the windows.
"Jump out! The bushes will break your fall!"
But he's frozen, staring at the bottleneck in Curry's hands. Now the door to the library is quaking, hot air building on the other side. Tendrils of smoke are starting to stream in from beneath the door, and I can feel my eyes watering, my chest getting heavy.
"Paul!"
I cry through the smoke.
"You have to get out!"
"Richard!" Paul yells.
"Come on! Let him go!"
I bellow at Curry, but now the fire is roaring to be let in. From beyond comes a terrible ripping sound, wood tearing under its own weight. Suddenly, Gil collapses onto the wall beside me. I rush to the window and open it, propping him against the frame, struggling to keep him upright.
"Help, Paul,"
Gil mumbles, the last thing he says to me before the life begins to fade from his eyes. A frigid wind strikes through the room, kicking up snow from the bushes below. As gently as I can, I lift him into position. He looks angelic in the light, effortless even now. Staring down at the bloody handkerchief, clinging to his arm out of nothing but its own weight, I begin to feel everything dissolve around me. With one last look, I let go. In an instant, Gil is gone.
"Tom!"
comes Paul's voice, so distant now that it seems to come from a cloud of smoke.
go!
I turn to see Paul struggling in Curry's arms, trying to pull him toward the window, but the old man is much stronger. He won't be moved. Curry shoves Paul toward the service stairs instead.
Jump!
I hear below me, voices pouring up through the open window.
Jump down!
Firefighters spotting me inside. But I turn back.
Paul!
I yell.
Come on! Go, Tom!
I can hear him say one last time.
Please!
The words become distant too quickly, as if Curry has carried him down into the haze. The two of them are retreating into the ancient bonfires, wrestling like angels through the lifetimes of men. Down is the final word I hear from inside the room, spoken in Curry's voice.
Down!
And again from outside.
Hurry! Jump!
Paul!
I scream, backing up toward the ledge of the window as the flames begin to corner me. Hot smoke presses like a fist against my chest. Across the room, the door to the service stairs swings shut. There's no one to be seen. I let myself fall. Those are the last things I remember before the slush of snow engulfs me. Then there's only an explosion, like a sudden dawn at midnight. A gas pipe bringing the entire building to its feet, and the soot begins to fall. In the silence, I'm shouting. To the firemen, to Gil, to anyone who'll listen. I've seen it, I'm shouting. Richard Curry opening the entrance to the service stairs, pulling Paul away.
Listen to me!
And at first, they do. Two firemen, hearing me, approach the building. A medic is beside me, trying to understand.
What stairs?
He asks. Where do they come out?
The tunnels, I tell him. They come out near the tunnels.
Then the smoke clears, and the hoses make sense of the club's face, and everything begins to change. There's less searching, less listening. There's nothing left, they're saying, in the slowness of their steps. There is no one inside this.
Paul is alive, I shout. I saw him.
But every second is a strike against him. Every minute is a fistful of sand. By the way Gil's looking at me now, I realize how much has changed. I'm okay, he says to the medic tending his arm. He wipes a wet cheek, then points to me. Help my friend. The moon hangs over us like a watchful eye, and as I sit there, staring past the silent men who hose down the shattered clubhouse, I imagine Paul's voice.
Somehow,
he says, far away, staring at me over coffee,
I feel like he's my father, too.
Over the black curtain of the sky, I can see his face, so full of certainty that I believe him even now.
So what do you think?
He's asking me. About you going to Chicago?
About us going to Chicago.
Where we were taken that night, what questions were asked of us, I don't remember. The fire kept burning in front of me, and Paul's voice hummed in my ears as though he might still rise from the flames. I saw 1,000 faces before that sunrise, bearing messages of hope, friends roused from their rooms by the fire, professors awakened in their beds by the sound of sirens. The chapel service itself stopped in mid-reading by the spectacle of it all. And they gathered around us like a traveling treasury, each face a coin, as if it had been declared on high that we ought to suffer our losses by counting what remained. Maybe I knew then that it was a rich, rich poverty we were entering. What dark comedy the gods favored who made this. My brother Paul, sacrificed on Easter. The tortoise shell of irony dropped heavy on our heads. That night,
the three of us survived together out of necessity. We met in the hospital, Gil and Charlie and I, bedfellows again. None of us spoke. Charlie fingered the crucifix around his neck. Gil slept, and I stared at the walls. Without news about Paul, we all invested ourselves in the myth of his survival, the myth of his resurrection. I should have known better than to believe there was anything indivisible about a friendship, any more than there was about a family. And yet the myth of it sustained me then and ever after. Myth, I say, and never hope, for the box of hope lay empty. Chapter 29. Time, like a doctor, washed its hands of us. Before Charlie was even out of the hospital, we'd become old news. Classmates stared at us as if we were out of context, fugitive memories with an aura of former significance. Within a week, the cloud of violence over Princeton had burned off. Students began to walk across campus after dark again, first in groups, then alone. Unable to sleep, I'd wander off to the Wawa in the middle of the night, only to find it full of people. Richard Curry lived on in their conversations. So did Paul. But gradually the names I knew disappeared, replaced by exams and varsity lacrosse games and the yearly spring talk, a senior who'd slept with her thesis advisor, the final episode of a favorite television show. Even the headlines I read while waiting in line at the register, the ones that kept my mind off being alone when everyone else seemed to be with friends, suggested that the world had moved forward without us. On the 17th day after Easter, the front page of the Princeton Packet announced that a plan for an underground parking lot in town had been nixed. Only at the bottom of page 2 was it reported that a wealthy alumnus had donated $2 million toward the rebuilding of Ivy. Charlie was out of his hospital bed in 5 days, but spent another 2 weeks in rehab. Doctors suggested cosmetic surgery on his chest, where patches of his skin had become thick and gristly, but Charlie refused. I visited him at the medical center every day but one. Charlie wanted me to bring him potato chips from the Wawa, books for his classes, scores from every Sixers game. He always gave me a reason to come back. More than once, he made a point of showing me his burns. At first I thought it was to prove something to himself, that he didn't feel disfigured, that he was much stronger than what had happened to him. Later I sensed that the opposite was true. He wanted to make sure I knew he had been changed by this. He seemed to fear that he'd stopped being a part of my life and Gil's at the moment he ran into the steam tunnels after Paul. We were getting along without him, mending our losses alone. He knew we'd begun to feel like strangers in our own skins, and he wanted us to know that he was in the same position, that we were all still in this together. It surprised me that Gil visited him as much as he did. I was there for a few of the visits, and there was the same awkwardness every time. Both of them felt guilty in a way that was intensified by seeing the other. However irrational, Charlie felt that he'd abandoned us by not being at Ivy. At times, he even saw Paul's blood on his own hands, weighing Paul's death as the price of his own weakness. Gil seemed to feel that he himself had abandoned us long ago, in a way that was harder to express. That Charlie could feel so guilty, having done so much, only made Gil feel worse. One night before he went to bed, Gil apologized to me. He said he wished he'd done things differently. We deserved better. From that night on, I never found him watching old movies. He took his meals at restaurants that seemed farther and farther from campus. Every time I invited him to lunch at my club, he found a reason not to come. It took 4 or 5 rejections for me to understand that it wasn't the company he objected to. It was the thought of seeing Ivy on the way there. When Charlie got out of the hospital, he and I were together breakfast, lunch, and dinner. More and more, Gil ate and drank alone.
Slowly, our lives fell out of scrutiny. If we felt like pariahs at first, when everyone grew tired of hearing about us, then we felt like ghosts afterward, when everyone began to forget. The university's memorial service for Paul was held in the chapel, but could have fit in a small classroom, for the tiny crowd it drew. Hardly as many students as professors, and most of those just members of the EMT squad or of Ivy, showing up out of compassion for Charlie or Gil. The only faculty member who approached me after the service was Professor LaRocque, the woman who first sent Paul to see Taft, and even she seemed interested only in the hypnerotomachia, in Paul's discovery rather than in Paul himself. I told her nothing, and made a point of doing the same every time the hypnerotomachia came up after that. I thought it was the least I could do, not giving away to strangers the secret Paul had worked so hard to keep between friends. What briefly caused a resurgence of interest was the discovery, a week after the headline about the underground parking lot, that Richard Curry had liquidated his assets just before leaving New York for Princeton. He had placed the money in a private trust, along with the residual properties of his auction house. When banks refused to reveal the terms of the trust, Ivy asserted a right to the money as compensation for its damages. Only when the club's board decided that not a stone of the new building would be bought with Curry's money did the flap subside. Meanwhile, papers flocked to the news that Richard Curry had left all of his money to an unnamed trustee, and a few even suggested what I already believed, that the money was meant for Paul. Knowing nothing of Paul's thesis, though, the greater public could make little sense of Curry's intentions, so they dug into his friendship with Taft until the two men became a farce, an explanation for all evil that was no explanation at all. Taft's home at the Institute became a ghost house. New Institute fellows refused to live there, and townie teenagers dared each other to break in. The only benefit of the new climate, the one of fantastic theories and sensational headlines, was that it soon became impossible to suggest that Gil and Charlie and I had done anything wrong at all. We weren't flamboyant enough to play a role in what had happened, bizarre as everyone thought it was, not when the local news could fill its coverage with pictures of Rasputin Taft and the lunatic Curry who killed him. The police and the university both acknowledged that they had no intention of pursuing any action against us, and I suppose it made a difference to our parents that we would graduate without disgrace. None of it mattered much to Gil, since that sort of thing never did, and I couldn't get around to giving much of a damn myself. Still, I think it took a load off Charlie's mind. He lived increasingly in the shadow of what had happened. Gil called it a persecution complex, the way he expected misfortune at every turn, but I think Charlie had simply convinced himself that he could have saved Paul. Whatever it was, there was going to be a reckoning for his failures, if not at Princeton, then in the future. It wasn't so much persecution Charlie feared. It was judgment. The only hint of pleasure in my final days of college came from Katie. At first, she brought food to Gil and me while Charlie was still in the hospital. In the wake of the fire, she and other Ivy sophomores had begun a co-op, buying their own food and making their own meals. Afraid that we weren't eating, she always cooked for three. Later, she'd take me on walks, insisting that the sun had restorative powers, that there were traces of lithium in cosmic rays you could only catch at dawn. She even took pictures of us, as if she saw something in those days worth remembering. The photographer in her was convinced that the solution lay somehow in the right exposure to light. Without Ivy in her life, Katie seemed even closer to what I wanted her to be, and even less like the side of Gil I never understood. Her spirits were always up, and her hair was always down. The night before graduation, she invited me back to her room after a movie, claiming she wanted me to say goodbye to her roommates. I knew she meant something else, but that night I told her I couldn't do it. There'd be too many pictures of the certainties she carried with her, family and old friends and the dog at the foot of her bed in New Hampshire. A final night in a room surrounded by all her fixed stars would only remind me of how much my own life was in flux.
We watched in those final weeks as the investigation into the fire at Ivy drew to a close. At last, on the Friday before commencement, as though the announcement had been timed to give closure to the academic year, the local authorities acknowledged that Richard Curry, in a way coincident with first-hand accounts, precipitated a fire within the Ivy Club, causing the death of both men inside the building. In support of this, they advanced two shards of a human jaw, which matched Curry's dental records. The explosion of the gas main had left little else. Yet the investigation remained open, and nothing specific was ever said of Paul. I knew why. Just 3 days after the explosion, an investigator had confessed to Gill that they held out hope of Paul's survival. The remains they'd found were merely scraps, and what few of them were identifiable were Curry's. For the following days, then, we waited hopefully for Paul's return. But when he never did return, never staggered from the woods or turned up in a familiar place, having forgotten himself for a time, the investigators seemed to realize it was better to be silent than to ply us with false hope. Graduation came, warm and green, without a whisper of wind, as though such a thing as Easter weekend could never have been. There was even a butterfly in the air, fluttering like a displaced emblem as I sat in the yard of Nassau Hall, surrounded by classmates in our robes and tassels, waiting to be pronounced. Up there in the tower, I imagined a bell tolling silently without a clapper, Paul celebrating our fortune just behind the creases of the world. There were phantoms everywhere in that daylight. Women in evening gowns from the Ivy Ball, dancing in the sky like nativity angels, announcing a new season. Nude Olympians, streaking in the courtyards, unashamed of their nakedness, in a specter of the season just past. The salutatorian quipped in Latin jokes I didn't understand, and for an instant I imagined that it was Taft up there who addressed us. Taft, and behind him Francesco Colonna, and behind them a chorus of wizened philosophers, who all delivered a solemn refrain like drunken apostles singing the battle hymn of the Republic. The three of us returned to the room one last time after the ceremony. Charlie was heading back to Philadelphia for a summer of ambulance work before medical school in the fall. He had chosen the University of Pennsylvania, he told us finally, after wavering for so long. He wanted to stay near home. Gil was collecting the knick-knacks from his bedroom with a touch of eagerness I half expected. He confessed to having a ticket out of New York that evening. Going to Europe for a while, he said. To Italy, of all places. He needed some time to figure things out. We collected our last day's mail together, Charlie and I, once Gil was gone. Inside the box were four small envelopes, identical in size. They contained registration slips for the alumni directory, one to each of us. I placed mine in my pocket and took Paul's as well, realizing he hadn't been stricken from our class list. I wondered for a moment if they'd drawn up a diploma for him, too, which now sat somewhere uncollected. But on the fourth envelope, the one addressed to Gil, his name had been crossed off, and mine had been written in his hand. I opened it and read. The form had been completed, with an address penned out for a hotel in Italy. "Dear Tom," it said across the inside lip of the envelope, "I left Paul's here for you. I thought you'd want it. Tell Charlie I'm sorry for leaving in a rush. I know you understand. If in Italy, please call. G." I hugged Charlie before we parted. A week later, he called me at home to ask if I planned to attend our class reunion the following year. It was the sort of pretext only Charlie would invent for a phone call, and we spoke for several hours. Finally, he asked if I'd give him Gil's address in Italy. He said he'd found a postcard Gil would enjoy, which he tried to describe to me. I realized, underneath what he was saying, that Gil hadn't given him a forwarding address. Things between them had never really recovered. I wasn't in Italy, that summer or afterward. Gil and I met 3 times in the 4 years that followed, each time at a class reunion. There was less and less to be said between us. The facts of his life gradually assembled with the graceful preordination of words in a litany. He returned to Manhattan after all. Like his father, he became a banker. Unlike me, he seemed to age well. At 26, he announced his engagement to a beautiful woman 1 year our junior, who reminded me of a star from an old movie. Seeing them together, I could no longer deny the pattern to Gil's life. Charlie and I kept up much better. To be honest, he wouldn't let me go. He holds the distinction in my life of being the hardest working friend I've ever had, the one who refuses to let a friendship fail just because the distance grows and the memories fade. In the first year of medical school, he married a woman who reminded me of his mother. Their first child, a daughter, was named after her. Their second child, a son, was named after me. A bachelor myself, I can judge Charlie as a father honestly, without worrying how I fare in comparison. The only way to do it justice is to say that Charlie is an even better father than friend. In the way he cares for his children, there's a hint of the natural protectiveness, the world-beating energy, the enormous gratitude for the privilege of life that he always showed at Princeton. Today he's a pediatrician, God's own doctor. His wife says that on certain weekends he still runs with the ambulance. I hope someday, as he still believes, Charlie Freeman will come before heaven at the hour of judgment. I've never known a better man. What became of me, I'm hard-pressed to say. After graduation, I returned to Columbus. Except for a single trip to New Hampshire, I spent all 3 months of my summer at home. Whether it was because my mother understood my loss even better than I did, or because she couldn't help feeling glad that Princeton was behind me, behind us, she opened up. We talked. She joked. We ate together, just the two of us. We sat on the old sledding hill, the one my sisters used to pull me up, and she told me what she'd been doing with herself. There were plans to open a second bookstore, this one in Cleveland. She explained the business model, the way she'd been running the ledgers, the possibility of selling the house now that it was going to be empty. I understood only the most important part, which was that she'd finally started moving on. For me, though, the problem wasn't moving on. It was understanding. As the years have passed, the other uncertainties of my life have seemed to clarify themselves in a way my father's life never did. I can imagine what Richard Curry was thinking on that Easter weekend, that Paul was in the same position Curry himself had once been in, that it would be unbearable to let his orphan son become another Bill Stein or Vincent Taft or even Richard Curry. My father's old friend believed in the gift of a clean slate, a blank check on an unlimited trust. It just took us too long to understand him. Even Paul, in the days when I still hoped for his survival, gave me reason to think he'd simply left us all behind, escaping through the tunnels without ever returning. The dean had left him with little hope of graduation, and I had left him with no hope of Chicago. When I'd asked him where he wanted to be, he'd told me honestly, in Rome with a shovel. But I never reached the age when I could ask my father those sorts of questions, even if, in retrospect, he was probably the sort of man to give them an honest answer. I suppose then, looking back on it, that the only way I can explain why I became an English major after having lost my faith in books, why I had such a sense of possibility working on Colonna's book after rejecting my father's love of it, is that I was looking for those pieces I thought my father must have left me, the ones that could piece him back together. For as long as I knew Paul, for the duration of our research on the hypnerotomachia, the answer almost seemed to be in my grasp. For as long as we worked together, there was always hope that I might eventually understand. When that hope fled, I honored my contract and became a software analyst. The job I got by solving a riddle I took because I'd failed to solve another. Time in Texas passed more quickly than I can account for. The heat of summer there reminded me of nothing I'd known before, so I stayed. Katie and I wrote almost weekly during her last 2 years at Princeton, letters I began to wait for in the mail even as they became less frequent. The last time I saw her was during a trip to New York to celebrate my 26th birthday. By the end of it, I think even Charlie could sense that time had come between Katie and me. As we walked through Prospect Park in the autumn sun, near the Brooklyn Gallery where Katie worked, I began to understand that the things we once cherished had remained behind us at Princeton, and that the future had failed to replace them with a vision of things yet to come. Katie, I knew, had been hoping to begin something new that weekend, to chart a new course by a new set of stars. But the possibility of rebirth, which had buoyed my father for so long and preserved his faith in his son, was an article of faith I'd slowly come to doubt. After that weekend, I began to fall out of Katie's life entirely. Shortly afterward, she called me at work for the last time. She knew the problem lay on my end of things, that mine were the letters that had become shorter and more distant. Her voice brought back an ache I hadn't expected. She told me I wouldn't be hearing from her again until I figured out for myself where we stood. Finally, she gave me her number at a new gallery and told me to call when things were different. Things were never different. Not for me, anyway. It wasn't long before my mother's new bookstore prospered, and she called me back to run the one in Columbus. I told her it was too difficult to leave Texas, now that I had roots. My sisters visited me and Charlie with his family once, each leaving with advice on how I could get myself out of this slump, how I could get past this whatever it was. The truth is, I've just been watching things change around me. The faces are younger every year, but I see the same formulations in all of them, reissued like money, new priests in old denominations. I remember that in the economics class I took with Brooks, we were taught that a single dollar, circulated long enough, could buy everything in the world, as if commerce were a candle that could never burn itself out. But I see that same dollar now in every exchange. The goods it buys I no longer need. Most days they hardly seem like goods at all. It was Paul who weathered time's passage the best. He always remained at my side, 22 and brilliant, like an incorruptible Dorian Gray. I believe it was when my engagement to an assistant professor at the University of Texas began to collapse, a woman who reminded me, I see now, of my father and mother and Katie all at once, that I took to calling Charlie every week and thinking of Paul more and more. I wonder if he wasn't right to go out as he did, striving, young, while we, like Richard Curry, suffered the depredations of age, the disappointments of a promising youth. Death is the only escape from time, it seems to me now. Maybe Paul knew he was beating it all along, past, present, and any distinction in between. Even now, he seems to be leading me toward the most important conclusions of my life. I still consider him my closest friend. Chapter 30. Maybe, then, I'd made my decision before I ever received this package in the mail. Maybe the package was only the accelerant, like the alcohol Parker spilled on the club floor that night. Not even 30, and I feel like an old man. The eve of our fifth reunion, and 50 years seem to have gone by. Imagine, Paul said to me once, that the present is simply a reflection of the future. Imagine that we spend our whole lives staring into a mirror with the future at our backs, seeing it only in the reflection of what's here and now. Some of us would begin to believe that we could see tomorrow better by turning around to look at it directly. But those who did, without even realizing it, would have lost the key to the perspective they once had. For the one thing they'd never be able to see in it was themselves. By turning their backs on the mirror, they'd become the one element of the future their eyes could never find. At the time, I thought Paul was parroting wisdom he'd gotten from Taft, which Taft had stolen from some Greek philosopher, the idea that we spend our lives backing into the future. What I couldn't see, because I was turned the wrong way, was that Paul meant it for me, about me. For years, I've been determined to get on with my life by doggedly hunting down the future. It was what everyone told me I should do, to forget the past, to look forward, and in the end, I did it better than anyone might have expected. When I arrived, though, I began to imagine that I knew exactly what my father felt, that I could identify with the way things seemed to turn against him with no explanation. The fact is, I don't know the first thing about it. I turn around now toward the present and find that I've had nothing like the disappointments he experienced. In a business I knew nothing about, which never captured my heart, I've done well for myself. My superiors marvel that after being the last man out of the office for 5 years, I've never taken a single day off. Not knowing any better, they mistake it for devotion. Seeing that now, and comparing it to the way my father never did anything he didn't love, I come to a certain understanding. I don't know him any better than I ever did, but I know something about the position I've taken all these years, turning to stare at the future. It's a blind way to face life, a stance that lets the world pass you by, just as you think you're coming to grips with it. Tonight, long after leaving the office, I quit my job in Texas. I watched the sun go down over Austin, realizing it had never once snowed in all my time here, not in April, not even in midwinter. I've almost forgotten what it feels like to crawl into a bed so cold you wish there was someone else in it. Texas is so hot, it helps you believe you're better off sleeping alone. The package was waiting at my house when I came back from work today. A little brown mailing tube propped against my door, so unexpectedly light I thought it might be empty. There was nothing on the outside but my house number and postal code, no return address, only a handwritten routing number in the left corner. I remembered a poster Charlie said he was sending me, an Aikens painting of a lone rower on the Schuylkill River. He'd been trying to convince me to move closer to Philadelphia, trying to convince me that it was the right city for a man like me. His son should see more of his godfather, he said. Charlie thought I was slipping away. So I cracked the tube open, saving it for after the regular mail, the credit card offers and sweepstakes notifications, and nothing that resembled a letter from Katie. In the glow of the television, the barrel seemed hollow. No poster from Charlie, no message. Only when I stuck my finger inside did I feel something thin curled around the circumference. One side of it felt glossy, the other side ragged. I pulled it out less gently than I should have, considering what it was. Bottled inside the little package was an oil painting. I rolled it open, wondering for a second if Charlie had outdone himself and bought me an original. But when I saw the image on the canvas, I knew better. The style was much older than 19th century American, much older than any century American. The subject was religious. It was European, from the first true age of painting. It's difficult to explain the feeling of holding the past in your hands. The smell of that canvas was stronger and more complex than anything in Texas, where even wine and money are young. There was a trace of the same smell at Princeton, possibly at Ivy, certainly in the oldest rooms of Nassau Hall. But the odor was much more concentrated here, in this tiny cylinder. The smell of age, hardy and thick. The canvas was dark with grime, but slowly I made out the subject. In the background stood the statuary of ancient Egypt, obelisks and hieroglyphs and unfamiliar monuments. In the foreground was a single man to whom others had come in submission. Seeing a hint of pigment, I looked more closely. The man's robe was painted with a brighter palette than the rest of the scene. In the dusty desert, it was radiant. This man before me I hadn't thought of in years. It was Joseph, now a great official in Egypt, rewarded by the Pharaoh for interpreting dreams.
Joseph revealing himself to his brothers, who came to buy grain, the very brothers who left him for dead so many years before. Joseph restored to his coat of many colors. On the bases of the statuary had been painted three inscriptions. The first read,
Crescebat autem quotidie fames in omni terra operuit que Joseph universa horia.
There was famine all over the world. Then Joseph opened the granaries.
Then, Festinavitque quia commota fuerant viscera eus. Super fratres suo et erumpebat lacrimae et entroyens cubiculum flevit.
Joseph hurried out. So strong was the affection he felt for his brother that he wanted to cry. On the base of the third statue was simply a printed signature, Sandro Di Mariano, better known by the nickname his older brother gave him, Little Barrel, or Botticelli. By the date below his name, the canvas was over 500 years old. I stared at it, this relic that only one other pair of hands had touched since the day it was sealed below ground. Beautiful in a way that no humanist could resist, with its pagan statuary that Savonarola could never abide. Here it was, nearly destroyed by age, but somehow still intact, still vibrant beneath the soot, alive after all this time. I laid it on the table when my hands became too unsteady to hold it, and I reached into the tube again, looking for something I'd missed. A letter, a note, even just a symbol, but it was empty. The handwriting on the outside, spelling out my address with such care, but nothing else. Only postmarks and a routing code in the corner. Then that routing code caught my eye. 39-055-210185-GEN-4519. There was a pattern to it, like the logic of a riddle. It formed an exchange, a phone number overseas. At the dark end of a bookshelf, I found a volume someone had given me for Christmas years ago, an almanac with its catalogs of temperatures and dates and zip codes suddenly useful. Toward the back was a list of foreign prefixes. 39, the country code for Italy. 055, the area code for Florence. I stared at the rest of the numbers, beginning to feel the return of my pulse, the old drumming in my ears. 210185, a local phone number. GEN-4519, possibly a room number, an extension. He was at a hotel, in an apartment. There was famine all over the world. Then Joseph opened the granaries. I looked back at the painting, then over at the mailing tube. GEN-4519. Joseph hurried out. So strong was the affection he felt for his brother that he wanted to cry. GEN-4519. GEN-4519. In the home I'd made, it was easier to find an almanac than a Bible. I had to rummage through old boxes in my attic before coming across the Bible that Charlie claimed to have left behind accidentally after his last visit. He thought he might be able to share his faith with me, the certainties that came with it. Indefatigable Charlie, hopeful to the end. I have it now in front of me. Genesis, chapter 45, verse 19, comes at the conclusion of the story Botticelli painted. After revealing himself to his brothers, Joseph becomes a gift-giver, just like his father before him. After all he has suffered, he says he'll take his brothers back, they who now starve in Canaan, and let them share in the bounty of his Egypt. And I, who have made the mistake most of my life of trying to leave my father behind me, of thinking I could move forward by keeping him in the past, I understand perfectly. Get your father and come, the verse says. Never mind about your property, for the best of all Egypt will be yours.
I pick up the phone. "Get your father and come," I think, wondering how he understood even when I didn't. I put the phone back down and reach for my daybook to copy the number before anything can happen to it. In those lonely pages, the new H of Paul Harris and the old M of Katie Marchand are the only two entries on the spread. It feels unnatural to add a name now, but I'm fighting the sensation that all I have is this set of digits on the mailing tube, a single chance that could be erased by the simplest mistake, an opportunity that could bleed into nothing beneath a single drop of water. There's sweat on my hands as I lift the receiver again, hardly aware of the time that has passed as I sat here, trying to think of the words to put to this. Out the bay window of my bedroom, in the glittering Texas night, I can see nothing but the sky. Never mind about your property, for the best of all Egypt will be yours. I refresh the dial tone and start pushing the buttons on the keypad. A number I never thought my fingers would form, a voice I never thought I'd hear again. There's a distant buzz, the ringing of a telephone in another time zone. Then, after the fourth ring, a voice.
"You've reached Katie Marchand at the Hudson Gallery, Manhattan. Please leave a message."
Then a beep. "Katie," I say into the hum of silence, "this is Tom. It's almost midnight here, Texas time." The hush of the other end is haunting. It might have overwhelmed me if I didn't know exactly what I wanted to say. "I'm leaving Austin tomorrow morning. I'll be gone for a while. I'm not sure how long." There's a photo of the two of us in a small frame on my desk. We're slightly off-center, both holding one side of the camera and pointing it toward ourselves. The campus chapel is behind us, stony and still, Princeton whispering in the background even now. "When I get back from Florence," I tell her, the sophomore in my picture, my accidental gift, just before the machine in New York cuts off, "I want to see you." Then I place the receiver back in its cradle and stare out the window again. There'll be bags to pack, travel agents to call, new pictures to take. Even as I begin to realize the magnitude of what I'm doing, a thought occurs to me. Somewhere in the city of rebirth, Paul is lifting himself out of bed, staring out his window, and waiting. There are pigeons cooing on rooftops, cathedral bells tolling from towers in the distance. We're sitting here, continents apart, the same way we always did, at the edges of our mattresses, together. On the ceilings where I'm going, there will be saints and gods and flights of angels. Everywhere I walk, there will be reminders of all that time can't touch. My heart is a bird in a cage, ruffling its wings with the ache of expectation. In Italy, the sun is rising.
The Rule of Four was written by Ian Caldwell and Dustin Thomason. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.